on, again, seeking to place Greece within a comparative framework to try and see the kind of lessons that we could possibly derive from the Irish experience of the 1920s and 1930s. And of course, this fits very nicely with our attempt in the conference to place Greece really within a comparative perspective. A single country sort of analysis, I thought, would have been rather poor in terms of the kind of results that we can generate. So let us hear what Owen can say on this.
My name is Andre. I'm a researcher in University College Cork in Ireland. I suppose the key thing in an Irish context and why it's so relevant for Greece is that for the past 3 years, Irish government policy, official Irish government policy, has been to put as much clear water between the situation in Ireland and the perceived situation in Greece. That is the fundamental aim of Irish government policy. I think what's interesting is that in the Irish media at the moment, there's, you know, about Greece every day, coalition governments, austerity measures, etc. But there is in fact a period of Irish history from the 20s and 30s which has direct relevance to the austerity programs going on in a lot of EU countries at the moment. I suppose the structure of this presentation is three main parts. I'm just going to present one slide at the start, just to give you an idea of the current economic situation in Ireland. I think it follows well follows up well to the previous presentation and the overview of the Greek economy. And then I'm just going to look at the period in Ireland, the Irish Free State from 22 to 32. It's what I describe as the attributes of austerity. They were comprised of the bankers and politicians, the public servants, and this concept is long rooted in Irish, the Irish economic framework, that of the outside expert. In Irish history, that would traditionally have been representatives of the British government, various parts of the imperial system, has been replaced currently that of the EU, the IMF and the ECB. And then finally, I suppose the key part, we're going to look at the relevance for Greece, not just for Greece, but really, I suppose, for the wider Eurozone. So from tiger to turtle, this is the deterioration in the Irish economic...
Is the turtle spotted? Is the turtle spotted? Did the tiger change its spots?
No, the Irish economy is incapable of changing its spots, unfortunately. I suppose deterioration in Ireland might have set in a bit earlier than is currently recognised. As of today, unemployment is about 14.5%. And I suppose the key figures really are the size and the scale of the increase in the national debt. In 2006, I think we had the second or the third lowest debt-to-GDP ratio in the EU. It was 24.7%. The Irish government parties in the 2007 general election campaign set out a programme for eliminating the national debt by 2020. Obviously, that was before the banking crisis. At the moment, direct bailouts to the Irish banks total $63 billion. That's been shouldered by the Irish taxpayer through the $25-odd billion from the National Pension Reserve, and the rest of the money borrowed from EU, ECB, IMF. I suppose the Irish economy has gone back to the old tradition of exporting its youth. We had a net inflow of 71,000 in 2006, a net outflow of over 34,000 is projected for this year. House prices are down around 50%, probably have about another 20 to 30% to go. Probably from an Irish context, the next major crisis won't be the banks. We've moved on from that. It will be the mortgage defaults. And it's also got generational aspects. It's predominantly focused on people in their late 20s, early 30s who purchased maybe over the last 10 years. The Irish economy, the GNP, is due to grow about 2% or 0.2% this year. Down from 6.5% in 2006. projections for next year have recently been revised down from about 3% to maybe 1.5%, but in all likelihood it will be a lot less than that. I suppose just to recap, in the Irish banking system, five of the main six Irish banks are wholly owned by the state, 98-99% shareholdings. So the Irish government, in effect, controls the Irish banking system. Just a brief summary of the situation back in 1922. That's when monetary and fiscal independence was achieved by Ireland. It was also when the country was officially partitioned between North and South. That was unfortunately followed by a brutal civil war. When partition was formalised in 1925, it resulted in the loss of the industrialised North East, the area around Belfast, which had traditional kind of shipbuilding, and more kind of industrial activities. Almost total trade dependence on the UK, 98% of exports went to the UK in 1924. And it was a very conservative banking and monetary policy based on maintaining the parity link with sterling. Upon monetary independence, Ireland, the Irish Free State, chose to keep the existing monetary arrangements. No change was made. So in effect, the Irish Free State was locked into a de facto monetary union with the UK. There was a parity, one Irish pound equaled one English pound sterling. So obviously that involved Ireland following the UK or following Britain back onto the gold standard in 1925 and back off it in 1931. And essentially the maintenance of that external objective to keep the sterling parity link overtook all domestic considerations. Independence, I suppose, from a political viewpoint, didn't result in an economic reawakening. It was a high level of cultural dependence on the UK. Treasury orthodoxies prevailed, and it's probably an incredible example of voluntary domestic austerity. Spending declined from 38 million to 26 million. The finance minister for those 10 years said it was his objective to run the country for as little as possible. In his second budget in 1924, as an independent Irish state, he cut the old age pension and abolished the unemployment assistance. Patrick McGilligan, who was the minister for industry at the time, asserted that people may have to die in this country and die of starvation, i.e. saying that the state couldn't be taken to support them. Social costs were subservient to traditional economic principles. I suppose the irony about the bankers is that totally embedded in the British financial system, there were nine main banks in Ireland in 1922 in the Irish Free State, but only four were actually headquartered in the Irish Free State. Three were headquartered in Belfast, which became Northern Ireland, stayed part of the UK, and two were headquartered in London. World War One had led to a huge boon, huge advantages for Irish agriculture. The British Army, the British people needed to be fed, so it led to a huge increase in Irish bank deposits. But from 1922, there was no independent Irish monetary policy. Irish interest rates followed the Bank of England rate, usually with an extra surcharge of maybe about a percentage point. The banks operated a pricing cartel. They met quarterly to decide how much to charge, where to open branches. I suppose it's a classic oligopoly. The Irish Free State had no lender of last resort. The debate at the current time about should the ECB step in. Similar debate in the Irish Free State in the 20s. The Irish banks and the Irish politicians assumed that the Bank of England would step in. Luckily that was never tested. Essentially the banks were slow to embrace the concept of a monetary independent Ireland, but once reconciled they exerted considerable influence. They were stable, conservative and looked to London rather than to Dublin. I suppose when looking at the bankers, you can view this kind of stability through a kind of lending austerity and through their political influence. That quote is from a submission of the Irish Congress of Trade Unions to the Banking Commission in 1935. And apart from the slightly outdated language, it could be written in any Irish daily newspaper today. And I think it probably represents the opinion of the vast majority of Irish people to the banks today. So it's a directly comparable experience, and it's in a sense it's coming from a slightly different direction, but it is history repeating itself. Again, the public servants, the Irish public servants who ran monetary policy were British, Irish, but trained in the British civil service model. Joseph Brennan is famous as the man who said no to every suggested innovation. These were classic British imperial first class civil servants who believed that the ultimate responsibility of an independent Ireland was to follow the British model. And essentially that maintained itself right up to the 1950s. I suppose of direct relevance to the current crisis is the fact that Ireland only gave up parity to the pound sterling in 1979. So it actually persisted up to the late 70s, and they only gave it up on account of joining the European monetary system. So one could argue that it was jumping from the fire pan eventually into the fire. But essentially, the last couple of slides, just to show that it was essentially highly conservative. You had conservatism on the part of the banks, you had caution on the part of the public servants, and from the politicians. And essentially, even the Bank of England viewpoint was that Irish Free State should have its own central bank, but the Irish were actually so conservative they didn't even want to make that decision by themselves. Hence, the concept of the outside expert. In the last 2 years, we've got 5 different reports in Ireland looking at why was there a banking crisis, why was there a housing crisis, all written by non-Irish outside experts. This concept goes right back to the 1920s when they were included to provide international legitimacy and deliver the right results. In the 20s, that was Henry Parker Willis from Columbia in the US. And in the 30s, it was Perry Atkinson from the Bank of International Settlements and later from the IMF, and T.E. Gregory from the London School of Economics. Essentially, they legitimised the framework for maintaining the parity linked to sterling, and in that they were supported by politicians, public service and bankers. Okay, so I suppose we can now look at relevance for Greece and the wider Eurozone from this period in Irish history. I've added in Scotland in this slide because it's directly relevant for debates regarding the move towards Scottish independence. Again, a move being resisted by the banks. They argue that, you know, RBS, majority owned outside of Scotland, you know, what effect would that have on
Join the Eurozone?
Scotland. I wouldn't imagine so. But
what's the Eurozone?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But the argument is that if Scotland would study the Irish example, I think that they would find some perhaps disturbing parallels. Number one, I suppose, prevailing economic orthodoxies drive political agendas. In the 20s, Irish economic policy was defined by the policy of free trade. It was the policy followed by the UK, yet 10 years later, protectionism, global protectionism. With economic dependence, banking conservatism, political caution, outlook of public servants legitimised by the outside experts. Essentially, the internal austerity was necessary to fulfil the external objectives of maintaining parity linked to sterling. social domestic impacts, unemployment, poverty levels, social welfare, immigration were not given precedence. Precedence was given to fulfilling the external role. And again, afraid to change due to fear of the alternatives. Two, in times of crisis, perhaps we have this Hollywood image that far-reaching and brave decisions are made in times of crisis. But that's not necessarily the case. And possibly you can see a lot of that in what will be going on in Brussels over the next 2 days. Even in times of crisis, suggestions of fundamental change will confront established, particularly banking in an Irish context, and political interests. The great example would be the 1931 gold standard crisis. In an Irish context, there was absolute panic that the UK would leave, followed by a general acceptance of we will do whatever they say. It's a good quote there from the political scientist Benjamin Cohen, who argues that uncertainty thus encourages a tendency towards what psychologists call mimesis, the rational impulse of risk-averse actors in conditions of contingency to minimise anxiety by imitative behaviour based on past experience. Actors tend to return to whatever served them right the last time. They don't necessarily make the giant leap that is probably required. Three, the Irish context shows that international commitments are more important than domestic concerns. But as I've mentioned, economic orthodoxies change over time. Domestic austerity linked to monetary external commitments. Voluntary nature is consistent, but mitigated by the, people talk of the impending doom scenario by leaving a monetary union. And outside experts provide support. Just a final slide, I suppose, based on historical Irish experience, and I suppose it follows on from the previous presentation. Austerity will not work in isolation. It will simply lead to social dissatisfaction and further contraction. There is always an alternative course, although it may lead to very significant short and medium-term economic costs. I noticed that right on cue, many of the European banks, UBS a couple of months ago, ING in the Netherlands, are bringing out these doomsday scenarios of what would happen in a country if it left monetary union. Established interests will seek to minimise change to protect their own position. I think you could just view that comment in the context of the behaviour maybe of some of the core states in the European Union. National debate generally sidelined by wider talk of international obligations. And the very final one, international experts or national experts with an international profile will lead domestic policy. And I think probably Italy probably would be the perfect example of that, in the sense of that domestic politicians are removed from the actual core of the decision-making process.